last week and this week, I talked about, last week and then this week, I will be talking about Jesus as the great shepherd. And really, that particular I am statement is very appropriate for something like a Palm Sunday or the whole Lenten season that we're a part of. The statement that Jesus made, I am the great shepherd, and I just sort of, I think I want to tell you this story first before I get into the text itself. It was a dramatic statement. It was a statement when Jesus made that declaration, I am the good shepherd, particularly after what had happened in John chapter 9. It established him in a way, I would think, with the religious leaders that would have sort of taken their breath away. They would have just been dumbfounded by that particular statement. And I sort of want to tell you why that is, but I want to tell you this story first. In all of our lives, we have people who probably functioned or performed some kind of shepherding kind of capacity in our life. And that is certainly true in history. There have been some wonderful people, Christianly speaking, who have been phenomenal shepherds of people. One of the people that comes to mind is a guy named David Livingstone. How many of you have ever heard of David Livingstone? He's one of the great missionaries of the 19th century. And really did a phenomenal work in particularly Central Africa in terms of taking the gospel there. Not only just taking the gospel, but having a tremendous amount to do with providing things like schools, hospitals, as well as the emancipation of slaves in Africa as well. Not just slaves that were taken up because of the, you know, during that time of colonialism, but also how Africans enslaved each other as well. So he did a tremendous work there. And his work was so profound that upon his death, this is what was said. David Livingstone died in Alala, southeast of Lake Bangweolu on May 1st, 1873. He died from malaria and internal bleeding because of dysentery, as was later to be established. He took his final breaths while kneeling in prayer at his bedside. Great Britain wanted his body to be returned for a proper ceremony. He was a national hero for the work that he had done in Africa in that regard. So they wanted him to be returned for a proper burial and ceremony. But the tribe that David Livingstone worked with would not give them his body. Finally, they relented, but before they did, they cut out his heart and put a note on the body which said, "You can have his body, but his heart belongs in Africa." Livingstone's heart was buried under a mouvela tree near the spot where he died. His body, together with his journal, was carried over 1,000 miles by his loyal attendants, Chuma and Susi, and was returned to Great Britain for burial at Westminster Abbey. Only the most highly regarded people are ever buried at Westminster Abbey in Great Britain. So here was a man who spent his whole life, he was a doctor, he was born extraordinarily poor, but felt called by God, and so did whatever he had to do to get his medical degree as well as a theology degree. And so when he was done, they wanted him to go to the East Indies, and he said, "No, there are enough missionaries in the East Indies. I want to go to some place where there's no gospel at all." And so he traversed his entire life. He traversed the whole of Central Africa, bringing the gospel, establishing hospitals and schools, and emancipating slaves. And his followers felt so powerfully about him that although it seems kind of macabre and horrific to you and me, they would not let go of his heart. It's a pretty powerful story, don't you think? Because David Livingston was a shepherd of his people. He protected them, he guided them, and he did all that at great risk to himself, and it even in the end cost him his life. So if you would, then, turn to John chapter 10, verses 11 through 21. And as you do that, let me again say that this shepherd imagery that Jesus talks about is an enduring image. And it is, in fact, the most common image throughout all of Scripture in terms of a metaphor. It is the most common metaphor used in terms of a shepherd and sheep. No, there's no other metaphor that's used over 400 times within the Scriptures. It's also interesting, if you think about it, that the most significant leaders in the Old and New Testament, well, especially the Old Testament, happened to be Abraham, who was a shepherd, Moses, who was a shepherd, and David, who was a shepherd. So Jesus is part of that lineage, that shepherd lineage, that great imagery as it is fulfilled in who he is. As I sat down to think about what I wanted to share with you, I was thinking about, what does it mean? What does it mean for a Christian to be an everyday shepherding kind of person? What does that mean? Because it's not just people like me. It's not just like pastors that are called a shepherd or missionaries that are called a shepherd, but it's for all of us. Anyone who's a believer, who is a part of the family of God, in God's providence, you are given opportunities to shepherd people into the faith. And so that image belongs to everyone. So, for me, for example, I can remember when I was a youth minister in Lancaster, Ohio, we had a very large youth ministry program, and it was very well known. It was a town not unlike Beaver. It was kind of a wealthy town. It was the county seat, like Beaver is. And so I was a part of the First Presbyterian Church, was a kind of a prominent church in that town. And we had about 220 kids in my youth ministry program. 70 of them were from our church. The rest were from all over the town. And so it was very well known. And I knew the mayor, the council people, a lot of them came to our church. I mean, we were on first-name basis, school officials, all that kind of stuff. I could get into any of the schools I wanted to. It was really a wonderful place to be because they trusted me and our church to shepherd kids properly. We had an internship program where we had two or three interns that we paid for to work with me. We educated them. We provided housing. We paid them a stipend, all those kinds of things. And one of them was named Donnie. And we had our youth programs. Oftentimes, we'd had small groups or whatever in people's homes. And so Don had we had this youth activity in a person's home, and there were a bunch of kids there. And as usual, these kids needed a ride home. So I took some, and Donnie took some. Well, that particular night, there were a group of kids there, two boys, who came for the first time. And they came because their mother worked with a mother who went to our church, and she, the other mother, had a lot of problems with her one son and her son's friend. A lot of problems, legally, with the law, and things like that. And she was talking to her friend who went to our church about what she could do with her son. And her son said, and the mother said, "Well, my son goes to this youth group, and they have a great time, and I think it's very healthy and very good, and getting him with good kids might be a great thing, so why don't you think about that?" So that woman sent her son and his friend to our youth group. So Donnie was going to take them home, plus some other kids. So Don did this little circuit like we all do in youth ministry, drop off the different kids, and then we ended up with him dropping off these two kids, and he got home around 9:45. As he walked in the door, this sort of problem kid who was about 14 or 15 years of age, the mother said, "Where in the world have you been? It's 9:45. So rather than saying, "Well, Don had a lot of kids to drop off," he said, "Well, Don and I and my friend, we went out to the park and we smoked some pot and drank some beer." So the mother went to to work the next day, and she said to her friend who went to our church, "I trusted you. I asked you for help, and this is what happened." And so the mother, not knowing exactly what happened, called me, and I was dumbfounded, and I knew that it didn't happen. So after praying about it, I called the prosecuting attorney who went to our church, and I said, "This is what happened. And I'm just, you know, how can we get at this?" And he said, "Well," he says, I can justify or legitimize you sending Don to the hospital, and we'll get him a drug test." So that's what we did. And they gave Don a drug test. It came back negative. I called the mother up and said, "This is the results of the drug test. I can send them to you. You can come look at them. I can stop by and show them to you. What would you like to..." And she was upset that the drug test was wrong. Now, it could have destroyed our program. All of my sheep that I had, right? It could have had a profound impact. But through the guidance and the wisdom of the Holy Spirit, we were able to protect them from this kind of thing. Does that make sense to you? So, you know, a shepherd should protect their charges, the sheep that God gives to them. I can tell you that over the years, that any of the students that I've had who were leaving high school to go off to college, that one of the things that I would do in terms of guidance was that I would hand them off to a ministry program in college, because there's a lot that goes on in college that isn't good. And so as a shepherd, I wanted to hand them off to somebody that I trusted, Coalition for Christian Outreach, Campus Crusade, whatever it was, to help protect them and guide them in their faith. I can't begin to tell you how many hours I've spent over the years one-on-one with people, both within this church as well as when I was in youth ministry, trying to guide people in their faith and in their walk. That's what a shepherd does. But we don't do that without some risk. Another great missionary, for example, who felt called to the Aka Indians in Peru, went there to share the gospel, and they, as he tried to lure them, they lured him in, and so both he and his four friends were murdered by these Indians. They were cannibals. And so you know what happened to them. But a year or so later, his wife, Elizabeth Elliott, undeterred, went to those same Indians, shared the gospel. They converted. And I will never forget the time that I was at Geneva College in 1984 with Elizabeth Elliott speaking before about 2,000 people, and she's reading from her memoirs, and what she says is this: "Here I am in our house in Peru with these Aka Indians. So-and-so is playing with little Jim." Little Jim is, she was pregnant when Jim went off to be a missionary. He died, and she had the baby, and after a period of time, she went to evangelize these Aka Indians. She's in this hut with her little son Jim, and the young man that Jim, little Jim, is playing with was one of the men who murdered her husband, who converted to the faith. Powerful story. But both Jim and Elizabeth Elliott would not be deterred in shepherding the people that God had placed before them, that he had called them to. So I want to say to you, I think this shepherding thing is something that we all have to be responsible for, and that we all have to embrace in whatever capacity the Lord has given it to us. So let me just ask you some of these questions real quickly. As Christian shepherds, do we strengthen the weak? Do we heal the sick? Do we bind up those who are injured? Do we bring back those who have strayed? Do we search for those who are lost? Have we placed ourselves in the lives of other people in such a way that we guide and protect? Do we do this? So let me read then John chapter 10, verses 11 through 21, and I'm going to read to you Ezekiel chapter 34. Jesus said, "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep. The hired hand is not the shepherd who owns the sheep. For when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. Then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. The man runs away because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for my sheep." Those of us who belong to Christ, who are part of his sheep, we know Jesus in the same way that Jesus knows the Father. We have that capacity. "I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up. This command I receive from my Father." And so I will leave it there. But I want then to go to Ezekiel chapter 34. Keeping in mind that when Jesus says, "I am the good shepherd," that, you remember when I was talking about "I am the gate," I spent two Sundays on that. This is the same audience. The same audience that heard him say, "I am the gate," is the same audience that heard him say, "I am the good shepherd." Not only that, the same audience that was in that vicinity, the same Pharisees, the same scribes, the same religious leaders who were with Jesus at that time, following him and sort of trying to trip him up, they were the very same ones who in chapter 9, John chapter 9, which precedes chapter 10, who had this encounter with the blind man. And so when Jesus goes from "I am the gate" to this encounter with the Pharisees and Jesus with this blind man, and now we get to chapter 10 of John, and Jesus says, "I am the good shepherd." And when he says, "I am the good shepherd," he is hearkening back to a text in the Old Testament that every religious leader there would have known and probably memorized. They would have known it. So when he says, "I am the good shepherd," he is basically indicting the religious leaders, the ruling people of his time. He is indicting them. And when they heard it, they had to have been dumbfounded that he would do something like this. So let's read it and see what he says. Ezekiel 34, verses 1 through 15. "The word of the Lord came to me," says Ezekiel, "Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel," that is the leaders. "Prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to you, shepherds of Israel, who only take care of yourselves. Should not shepherds take care of a flock? You eat curds," that's like really rich food. "You clothe yourselves with wool," the best of cloth that they could get, "and slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak, or healed the sick, or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally. So they were scattered because there was no shepherd. And when they were scattered, they became food for all the wild animals. My sheep wandered over all the mountains and on every high hill. They were scattered over the whole earth. No one searched or looked for them. Therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, because my flock lacks a shepherd, and so has been plundered, and has become food for all the wild animals, And because my shepherds did not search for my flock, but cared only for themselves rather than for my flock, therefore you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against the shepherds and will hold them accountable for my flock. I will remove them from tending the flock so that the shepherds can no longer feed themselves. I will rescue my flock from their mouths, and it will no longer be food for them. For this is what the sovereign Lord says. I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. So you have two things going on in this text. You have, first of all, this declaration that the shepherds are not doing their job. I guess you have three things. The second thing is that God is going to remove these shepherds. And the third thing is this, that he is going to appoint a new shepherd, that he's going to do something different. So this is what we call a messianic text. It points to the Messiah. That's what it does. It's an already and not yet thing. So he says in verse 12, as a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he is with him, so I will look after my sheep. I will rescue them from all the places where they were scattered on the days of clouds and darkness. I will bring them out from the nations and gather them from the countries, and I will bring them into their own land. I will pasture them on the mountains of Israel, in the ravines, and all the settlements of the land. I will tend them in good pasture, and mountain heights of Israel will be their grazing land. And they will lie down in good grazing land there, and there they will feed in a rich pasture on the mountains of Israel. I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord. I will search for the lost and bring back the strays. I will bind up the injured and strengthen the weak, but the sleek and the strong I will destroy. I will shepherd the flock with justice. That's the promise. And in the same way that that is what Christ is going to do and what Christ did, that is what we should do. So look, here's the indictment. Israel as a nation the leaders in Israel were to be shepherds to their people, and they failed. They became drunk with power, and they bought into other kinds of idolatry. And so as you follow this metaphor in the same way that in the same way that when sheep become scattered and become prey for animals, so because the people were leaderless and they scattered in terms of who God was and what God required, they began to get involved in other worldviews and other religions and other idolatries, and they began to practice those, and they became prey to those other religions. And so, in the same way, when we sort of leap forward to the New Testament then, where this is really fulfilled, we understand that what Jesus was saying was, look, I am that good shepherd in Ezekiel 34. And in the same way that the leaders in Israel didn't shepherd its people, because the leaders didn't shepherd their people, Israel could not shepherd the world. Does this make sense to you? Because that's what Israel is supposed to do. Isaiah 60, verses 1 through 3. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you, for darkness will cover the earth, and deep darkness its peoples. But my light will shine upon you, and nations will come to the brightness of your rising. Israel was supposed to be a light to the world, but they could not be a light to the world because the leaders within Israel did not shepherd, and as a result, Israel could not shepherd the world. And so we leap forward then to the New Testament, and so in the same way that the Pharisees were supposed to shepherd their people, and they did not, then collectively Israel could not shepherd the world. They did not strengthen the weak. The Pharisees did not heal the sick. The Pharisees did not bind up the injured. The Pharisees did not bring back the strays. They did not search for the lost. And as a result, the people of Israel became prey. I mean, when you read in the New Testament the condition of the average person in in Israel at that time, it's terrible. They are the poorest of the poor. And the ruling class, the religious leaders, as well as the secular leaders like Herod, lorded over those people. In fact, because the Pharisees failed in that way, we read later on where Peter says in 1 Peter 5:8, look, be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. These people were being devoured because the shepherds weren't doing their job. And if we don't have shepherds in our life, we are highly susceptible to our enemy, who is a roaring lion, prowling about, seeking someone who... Look, how many people do you know that that because they didn't receive the right counsel and the right guidance and the right protection, how many people do you... Look, how many kids grow up in homes where either or a parent will not protect them and will not guide them? And what happens to those kids? Are they susceptible to the enemy? Do you think they become prey to drug dealers? They become prey to any number of different kinds of people because there isn't somebody there to protect them. Their parents are not shepherding them. Maybe it's an adult. Maybe it's somebody who really means well, who intends well, but they're just not getting the right guidance and they're not getting some... I can't begin to tell you how many times I've had to run interference over the course of my life when somebody was trying to influence an adult or a kid in a way that was destructive to them. But my responsibility was to intercede and to get in the way of that. And if I didn't, they would become prey. And there are those people in your life. Providentially, God has brought people into your life. Now, you may not do the same kinds of things I do, but on a smaller scale, everybody here is supposed to do the same kinds of things I do. Because I'm in the same way that I'm trying to imitate Christ in that way, we're all supposed to imitate Christ in that way. I'm just trying to say to you, look, there's this world out there that's just full of lost sheep. I mean, they are lost. And they are susceptible. And in my lifetime, I have never seen the kind of viciousness in terms of worldviews in other religions and the way people think that to get people to think. I was just writing this morning and I said this. For most of the history of humankind, regardless of who practiced what religion, because we were made in the image of God, we had this sense of the law and having broken the law and that we had to appease something greater than us. So whether it meant appeasing Yahweh or whether it was appeasing some demon in the forest by offering our firstborn child as a sacrifice, there was this sense in all of us that we have violated the law. But more recently in our time. So they lived under the bondage of the law. They didn't know how to get out from under it. But today, hear me, in our culture, in modernity, in Western civilization, we live under the bondage of human grace. That we're really okay. There's nothing wrong. You're okay. I'm okay. It's just a matter of education. It's just a matter of us accepting everybody no matter what they do or what they're like. Because don't you understand? As human beings, we're on this. It's not about God. That's an old, archaic, mythological thing that we invented to make sense of the world. What it's really about is us understanding that we're evolving. We're evolving. And if we just have the right opportunities and the right education, we will evolve and we will become like God. And we will establish our own utopia. We don't need God to give that to us. That is the world that you live in, and that is the world that your kids are being educated with. Trust me when I say this. So we have switched from a sense of God and having violated it to a sense of becoming gods. That's the world we live in. It's completely different. At least if you lived in the former world, you had this sense of rightness and wrongness and law and having to submit and be obedient. Today, the only people that we submit to are ourselves. The only people we have to obey are ourselves. The only one that we trust to make sense of the world around us is ourself. And so, as a shepherd, I have to get in the way of that. And you will too. Because if that's what you believe, then you, in essence, believe what our ancient enemy believes. Because that's what Satan wanted. He wanted to be God. And there are many of us who think that, you know, he's right, even though we don't think of it that way. Look, in Matthew's seven woes, as Jesus is giving this discourse on I am the good shepherd, and he's basically telling them that they are like the shepherds who got fired, who reneged on the responsibility. Jesus goes on to say in Matthew 15, he says, "Woe to you teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You've given a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. You are blind guides. You strain out a gnat, but swallow a camel." Now, I don't have time to get into this, and I need to draw this to a conclusion, but let me just say, if you get a chance, read John chapter 9. Because in John chapter 9, there's this account where Jesus and his disciples run across a blind man who's been blind from birth. Now, understand that Jesus just talked about, I am the gate. Now we come into this section where Jesus encounters this blind man with his disciples, and his disciple says, "This blind guy right here, what about him? What sin does he have? And because back then, the Pharisees taught that if you were blind, you either had sin in your life or your parents had sin in their lives, and that's why you were blind. And Jesus said, this man has been blind since birth, and he's been blind for the glory of God, that God is going to use him in some way. So later on, Jesus heals him. And then he's supposed to go to the religious leaders and say, look, I'm healed. And the religious leaders look at him and say, well, yeah, you are healed, but when were you healed? Well, I was healed today. Well, but today's the Sabbath. So no godly man would heal on the Sabbath, is what the religious leaders thought. And so they thought Jesus had broken their law. And so over the course of time, what happens is that they examine this man, and it's really kind of amazing. In fact, let me just read. He says, Jesus said, he saw a blind man from birth. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Neither this man nor his parents sinned, Jesus said, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. So he was healed. They brought him to the Pharisees, and they interviewed him. They brought in his parents, and his parents were afraid of the Pharisees. They said, look, he's of age. He can speak for himself. All we know is he was blind. Now he sees. And so they said to this blind man, give glory to God, they said. We know this man, that is Jesus, is a sinner. And Jesus said, well, and the blind man said, how can you call him? He says, look, once I was blind, but now I see. And then he says, do you want to know this man too? And they said, no. He says, and he implies it, but this is a good man. And he says, and this is what the Pharisees say to him. They replied, you were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? And they threw him out of the synagogue. Do you see the irony here? Jesus had just, and so they were not the shepherds who were rejoicing that he was healed. They were not the shepherds who was helping this man who was begging to stay alive. They only believed that he was steeped in sin at birth, and they wanted nothing to do with him. The only thing they wanted to do with him was to use him to sort of trap Jesus. That was it. So what happens? Well, once he's thrown out, John chapter 9, 35 through 38. Jesus heard that they had thrown him out, and when he found him, what did Jesus do? He was thrown out of the Pharisee sheep pen, and the true shepherd, the shepherd from Ezekiel 34, says, went out and found him and said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" "Who is he, sir?" the man asked. "Tell me so that I may believe in him." Jesus said, "You have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you." Then the man said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. Amen. So Jesus healed, and Jesus went and got, and Jesus was the good shepherd. But in the same way that the good shepherds in the Old Testament were not, in the same way that the shepherds were not good shepherds in the Old Testament, so the Pharisees were not good shepherds in the time of Jesus. Very powerful. And not only that, but within a couple of hundred years, that whole religious caste, the Pharisees, the scribes, were gone. They were eliminated, never to come back again, just like Ezekiel said. So, in conclusion, and I know I've been a little bit all over the place, but let me just say this, that in the same way that Jesus makes this claim about being a good shepherd in a world that was terribly broken and depraved, so we are to be a good shepherd as well. And it can't be just your pastor, and it can't be just the elders. It just can't be, you know, sort of religious leaders. It has to be every one of us. And everyone in this room, you have family, and you have friends, and you have colleagues, and you have neighbors that providentially, according to God's plan, you have been placed in their life. You have been placed in their life. And those people need you, and they hunger for something more, and they don't understand who Jesus is, and Jesus has been misrepresented grievously by not only by the media, by higher education, and so they need to be guided, they need to be taught, they need the example of Jesus in our lives. And when we do this, we shepherd them. So I'm hopeful that you will partner with me over the course of this next year, throughout the course of the time that we are together, that you understand that you occupy a wonderful office, a tremendous opportunity. And if it's just one or two people in your life that you can bring into the fold, that you can love and protect, that you can give wise counsel to, that you seize that, you seize it, and you make it happen.